A Refutation of Deism, Percy Bysshe Shelley. It isn't so long since a test of Anglican orthodoxy was applied to anyone seeking to study or teach at Oxford and Cambridge universities. One of the most celebrated victims of this theocratic policy was Shelley, 1792-1811, who was expelled from University College, Oxford, for writing a pamphlet entitled The Necessity of Atheism. He and his poetry were much influenced by the climate of scepticism engendered by the French and Scottish Enlightenments, and he himself was to marry the daughter of the freethinker William Godwin. In this extract from A Refutation of Deism, Shelley sets about the propaganda of the creationists. Design must be proved before a designer can be inferred. The matter in controversy is the existence of design in the universe, and it is not permitted to assume the contested premises, and thence infer the matter in dispute. Insidiously to employ the words contrivance, design, and adaptation before these circumstances are made apparent in the universe, thence justly inferring a contriver is a popular sophism against which it behoves us to be watchful. To assert that motion is an attribute of mind, that matter is inert, that every combination is the result of intelligence, is also an assumption of the matter in dispute. Why do we admit design in any machine of human contrivance? Simply because innumerable instances of machines having been contrived by human art are present to our mind, because we are acquainted with persons who could construct such machines. But if, having no previous knowledge of any artificial contrivance, we had accidentally found a watch upon the ground, we should have been justified in concluding that it was a thing of nature, that it was a combination of matter, with whose cause we were unacquainted, and that any attempt to account for the origin of its existence would be equally presumptuous and unsatisfactory. The analogy which you attempt to establish between the contrivances of human art and the various existences of the universe is inadmissible. We attribute these effects to human intelligence because we know beforehand that human intelligence is capable of producing them. Take away this knowledge, and the grounds of our reasoning will be destroyed. Our entire ignorance, therefore, of the divine nature leaves this analogy defective in its most essential point of comparison. What consideration remains to be urged in support of the creation of the universe by a supreme being? Its admirable fitness for the production of certain effects, that wonderful consent of all its parts, that universal harmony by whose changeless laws innumerable systems of worlds perform their stated revolutions, and the blood is driven through the veins of the minutest animalculae that sports in the corruption of an insect's lymph. On this account did the universe require an intelligent creator, because it exists producing invariable effects? And inasmuch as it is admirably organized for the production of these effects, so the more did it require a creative intelligence. Thus have we arrived at the substance of your assertion, that whatever exists producing certain effects stands in need of a creator, and the more conspicuous is its fitness for the production of these effects, the more certain will be our conclusion that it would not have existed from eternity, but must have derived its origin from an intelligent creator. In what respect, then, do these arguments apply to the universe and not apply to God? From the fitness of the universe to its end you infer the necessity of an intelligent creator. But if the fitness of the universe to produce certain effects be thus conspicuous and evident, how much more exquisite fitness to his end must exist in the author of this universe? If we find great difficulty from its admirable arrangement in conceiving that the universe has existed from all eternity, and to resolve this difficulty suppose a creator, how much more clearly must we perceive the necessity of this very creator's creation, whose perfections comprehend an arrangement far more accurate and just. The belief of an infinity of creative and created gods, each more eminently requiring an intelligent author of his being than the foregoing, is a direct consequence of the premises, which you have stated. The assumption that the universe is a design leads to a conclusion that there are infinity of creative and created gods, which is absurd. It is impossible indeed to prescribe limits to learned error, when philosophy relinquishes experience and feeling for speculation. Until it is clearly proved that the universe was created, we may reasonably suppose that it has endured from all eternity. In a case where two propositions are diametrically opposite, the mind believes that which is less incomprehensible. It is easier to suppose that the universe has existed from all eternity than to conceive an eternal being capable of creating it. If the mind sinks beneath the weight of one, is it an alleviation to increase the intolerability of the burden? A man knows not only that he is now, but also that there was a time when he did not exist. Consequently, there must have been a cause. But we can only infer from effects causes exactly adequate to those effects. There certainly is a generative power which is affected by particular instruments. We cannot prove that it is inherent in these instruments, nor is the contrary hypothesis capable of demonstration. We admit that the generative power is incomprehensible, but to suppose that the same effects are produced by an eternal, omnipotent, and omniscient being leaves the cause in the same obscurity, but renders it more incomprehensible. We can only infer from effects causes exactly adequate to those effects. An infinite number of effects demand an infinite number of causes. Nor is the philosopher justified in supposing a greater connection or unity in the latter than is perceptible in the former. The same energy cannot be at once the cause of the serpent and the sheep, of the blight by which the harvest is destroyed, and the sunshine by which it is matured, of the ferocious propensities by which man becomes a victim to himself, and of the accurate judgment by which his institutions are improved. The spirit of our accurate and exact philosophy is outraged by conclusions that contradict each other so glaringly. The greatest, equally with the smallest motions of the universe, are subjected to the rigid necessity of inevitable laws. These laws are the unknown causes of the known effects perceivable in the universe. Their effects are the boundaries of our knowledge, their names the expressions of our ignorance. To suppose some existence beyond or above them is to invent a second and superfluous hypothesis to account for what has already been accounted for by the laws of motion and the properties of matter. I admit that the nature of these laws is incomprehensible, but the hypothesis of a deity adds a gratuitous difficulty, which, so far from alleviating those that it is adduced to explain, requires new hypotheses for the elucidation of its own inherent contradictions. The laws of attraction and repulsion, desire and aversion, suffice to account for every phenomenon of the moral and physical world. A precise knowledge of the properties of any object is alone requisite to determine its manner of action. Let the mathematician be acquainted with the weight and volume of a cannonball, together with the degree of velocity and inclination with which it is impelled, and he will accurately delineate the course it must describe, and determine the force with which it will strike an object at a given distance. Let the influencing motive present to the mind of any person be given, and the knowledge of his consequent conduct will result. Let the bulk and velocity of a comet be discovered, and the astronomer, by the accurate estimation of the equal and contrary actions of the centripetal and centrifugal forces, will justly predict the period of its return. The anomalous motions of the heavenly bodies, their unequal velocities and frequent aberrations, are corrected by that gravitation by which they are caused. The illustrious Laplace has shown that the approach of the moon to the earth and the earth to the sun is only a secular equation of a very long period, which has its maximum and minimum. The system of the universe, then, is upheld solely by physical powers. The necessity of matter is the ruler of the world. It is vain philosophy that supposes more causes than are exactly adequate to explain the phenomena of things. You assert that the construction of the animal machine, the fitness of certain animals to certain situations, the connection between the organs of perception and that which is perceived, the relation between everything which exists and that which tends to preserve it in existence, imply design. It is manifest that if the eye could not see, nor the stomach digest, the human frame could not preserve its present mode of existence. It is equally certain, however, that the elements of its composition, if they did not exist in one form, must exist in another, and that the combinations which they would form must, so long as they endured, derive support for their peculiar mode of being from their fitness to the circumstances of their situation. It by no means follows that because a being exists, performing certain functions, he was fitted by another being to the performance of these functions. So rash a conclusion would conduct, as I have before shown, to an absurdity, and it becomes infinitely more unwarrantable from the consideration that the known laws of matter and motion suffice to unravel, even in the present imperfect state of moral and physical science, the majority of those difficulties which the hypothesis of a deity was invented to explain. Doubtless no disposition of inert matter, or matter deprived of qualities, could ever have composed an animal, a tree, or even a stone. But matter deprived of qualities is an abstraction, concerning which it is impossible to form an idea. Matter, such as we behold it, is not inert. It is infinitely active and subtle. Light, electricity, and magnetism are fluids not surpassed by thought itself in tenuity and activity. Like thought, they are sometimes the cause and sometimes the effect of motion, and distinct as they are from every other class of substances with which we are acquainted, seem to possess equal claims with thought to the unmeaning distinction of immateriality. The laws of motion and the properties of matter suffice to account for every phenomenon or combination of phenomena exhibited in the universe. That certain animals exist in certain climates results from the consentaneity of their frames to the circumstances of their situation. Let these circumstances be altered to a sufficient degree, and the elements of their composition must exist in some new combination, no less resulting than the former from those inevitable laws by which the universe is governed. What then is this harmony, this order that you maintain to have required for its establishment, what it needs not for its maintenance, the agency of a supernatural intelligence? Inasmuch as the order visible in the universe requires one cause, so does disorder, whose operation is not less clearly apparent, demand another. Order and disorder are no more than modifications of our own perceptions of the relations which subsist between ourselves and external objects. And if we are justified in inferring the operation of a benevolent power from the advantages attendant on the former, the evils of the latter bear equal testimony to the activity of a malignant principle, no less pertinacious in inducing evil out of good than the other is unremitting in procuring good from evil. If we permit our imagination to traverse the obscure regions of possibility, we may doubtless imagine, according to the complexion of our minds, that disorder may have a relative tendency to unmingled good, or order be relatively replete with exquisite and subtle evil. To neither of these conclusions, which are equally presumptuous and unfounded, will it become the philosopher to assent. Order and disorder are expressions denoting our perceptions of what is injurious or beneficial to ourselves, or to the beings in whose welfare we are compelled to sympathize by the similarity of their conformation to our own. A beautiful antelope panting under the fangs of a tiger, a defenseless ox groaning beneath the butcher's axe, is a spectacle which instantly awakens compassion in a virtuous and unvitiated breast. Many there are, however, sufficiently hardened to the rebukes of justice and the precepts of humanity as to regard their deliberate butchery of thousands of their species as a theme of exultation and a source of honor, and to consider any failure in these remorseless enterprises as a defect in the system of things. The criteria of order and disorder are as various as those beings from whose opinions and feelings they result. Populous cities are destroyed by earthquakes and desolated by pestilence. Ambition is everywhere devoting its millions to incalculable calamity. Superstition, in a thousand shapes, is employed in brutalizing and degrading the human species, and fitting it to endure without a murmur the oppression of its innumerable tyrants. All this is abstractedly neither good nor evil, because good and evil are words employed to designate that peculiar state of our own perceptions, resulting from the encounter of any object calculated to produce pleasure or pain. Exclude the idea of relation, and the words good and evil are deprived of import. Earthquakes are injurious to the cities that they destroy, beneficial to those whose commerce was injured by their prosperity, and indifferent to others which are too remote to be affected by their influence. Famine is good to the corn merchant, evil to the poor, and indifferent to those whose fortunes can at all times command a superfluity. Ambition is evil to the restless bosom it inhabits, to the innumerable victims who are dragged by its ruthless thirst for infamy to expire in every variety of anguish, to the inhabitants of the country it depopulates, and to the human race whose improvement it retards. It is indifferent with regard to the system of the universe, and is good only to the vultures and the jackals that track the conqueror's career, and to the worms who feast in security on the desolation of his progress. It is manifest that we cannot reason with respect to the universal system from that which only exists in relation to our own perceptions. You allege some considerations in favor of a deity from the universality of a belief in his existence. The superstitions of the savage and the religion of civilized Europe appear to you to conspire to prove a first cause. I maintain that it is from the evidence of revelation alone that this belief derives the slightest countenance. That credulity should be gross in proportion to the ignorance of the mind that it enslaves is in strict consistency with the principles of human nature. The idiot, the child, and the savage agree in attributing their own passions and propensities to the inanimate substances by which they are either benefited or injured. The former become gods, and the latter demons. Hence, prayers and sacrifices, by the means of which the rude theologian imagines that he may confirm the benevolence of the one, or mitigate the malignity of the other. He has averted the wrath of a powerful enemy by supplications and submissions. He has secured the assistance of his neighbor by offerings. He has felt his own anger subside before the entreaties of a vanquished foe, and has cherished gratitude for the kindness of another. Therefore does he believe that the elements will listen to his vows. He is capable of love and hatred towards his fellow beings, and is variously impelled by those principles to benefit or injure them. The source of his error is sufficiently obvious. When the winds, the waves, and the atmosphere act in such a manner as to thwart or forward his designs, he attributes to them the same propensities of whose existence within himself he is conscious when he is instigated by benefits to kindness, or by injuries to revenge. The bigot of the woods can form no conception of beings possessed of properties differing from his own. It requires, indeed, a mind considerably tinctured with science, and enlarged by cultivation to contemplate itself, not as the center and model of the universe, but as one of the infinitely various multitude of beings of which it is actually composed. There is no attribute of God which is not either borrowed from the passions and powers of the human mind, or which is not a negation. Omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence, infinity, immutability, incomprehensibility, and immateriality are all words that designate properties and powers peculiar to organized beings, with the addition of negations, by which the idea of limitation is excluded. That the frequency of a belief in God, for it is not universal, should be any argument in its favor, none to whom the innumerable mistakes of men are familiar, will assert. It is among men of genius and science that atheism alone is found. But among these alone is cherished an hostility to those errors with which the illiterate and vulgar are infected. How small is the proportion of those who really believe in God to the thousands who are prevented by their occupations from ever bestowing a serious thought upon the subject, and the millions who worship butterflies, bones, feathers, monkeys, calabashes, and serpents. The word God, like other abstractions, signifies the agreement of certain propositions, rather than the presence of any idea. If we found our belief in the existence of God on the universal consent of mankind, we are duped by the most palpable of sophisms. The word God cannot mean at the same time an ape, a snake, a bone, a calabash, a trinity, and a unity. Nor can that belief be accounted universal, against which men of powerful intellect and spotless virtue have in every age protested. Intelligence is that attribute of the deity which you hold to be most apparent in the universe. Intelligence is only known to us as a mode of animal being. We cannot conceive intelligence distinct from sensation and perception, which are attributes to organized bodies. To assert that God is intelligent is to assert that he has ideas, and Locke has proved that ideas result from sensation. Sensation can exist only in an organized body. An organized body is necessarily limited both in extent and operation. The God of the rational theosophist is a vast and wise animal. Thus, from the principles of that reason to which you so rashly appealed as the ultimate arbiter of our dispute, have I shown that the popular arguments in favor of the being of God are totally destitute of color. I have shown the absurdity of attributing intelligence to the cause of those effects that we perceive in the universe, and the fallacy that lurks in the argument from design. I have shown that order is no more than a peculiar manner of contemplating the operation of necessary agents, that mind is the effect, not the cause of motion, that power is the attribute, not the origin of being. I have proved that we can have no evidence of the existence of a God from the principles of reason.